When something is called comedy, it is generally categorized as such because it's funny. If I spend $50 to see a comedian on the stage for an hour, he better be funny. And if I go to the theater to see a play that is marketed as a comedy, a screwball comedy, a dark comedy, or a romantic comedy, I expect it to be funny. But comedy, as it was perceived by those who lived thousands of years ago in ancient Greece or Rome, did not intend for comedy to mean primarily that it was funny. Comedy, in its strictest definition, was a story that began with chaos and disorder and eventually found its resolution in joy and order and redemption. That's why Dante's Divine Comedy is titled as such, because this epic poem begins with in the Inferno, in hell itself, and it ends in Paradiso, in heaven. And so, I guess that's why we can call this story, the one about Abraham and Sarah, we can call this story a little bit of a divine comedy as well, because it begins with chaos, it ends with joy, and in the middle, there is chaos, and there is laughter in the middle of that chaos. First, the backstory. Abraham often is referred to as the father of nations. How many of you messed up during the song singing Father Abraham? I did several times. They laughed at me because of that. But the father Abraham, they referred to him as this, as the father of nations. And he was called by God to leave his home and go to a new home with his wife Sarah, right? God is not very clear about those plans, but we see God's unfolding vision as the narrative progresses. And along the way, God makes promises to Abraham to believe that God is going to choose a family, and from that family, God will make a nation. And from that nation, God will show the world what God is like and what God is doing in the world. And Abraham, God promises, is going to be the patriarch of that family, and Sarah is to be its mother. But to have a family, one must have children, and this was a problem for Sarah because she could not have children. The Bible gives it a particularly cruel name, saying she is barren. And while we are not given insight into how Sarah felt about it, we can understand if Sarah would have felt bitterness and disappointment about not having a child. And that bitterness, no doubt, festered and it spread the older that Sarah got. The text for today tries to say it delicately, if not confusingly. Sarah was old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Yes, that doesn't make very little sense to me as well, but basically, to put it bluntly, she was 90 years old and way past menopause. I do not pretend to understand what Sarah was experiencing as she saw her body age or her chances at having a family fade like her eyesight and her hair color. Aging can be a brutal season of subtraction and loss, and not having a child, well, for Sarah, that just made it worse. And then to hear promises repeated about being a mother and father of a nation when they couldn't even start a family, well, that just seems like God was playing a cruel game with them. In the chapter right before this one, Abraham is once again given a promise, and he laughs out loud in giddy victory when God promises them this, that he is going to have a family. How bitter Sarah must have felt when she heard this. Kind of like a husband who repeatedly gets being promised that he is going to get a promotion, a spouse who is going to be here, is going to receive advancement. How bitter she must have felt when she heard these words come from Abraham again. And how bitter she must have felt towards God for making a promise that could not be kept. How very, very cruel this must have seemed. And so, this is how we find Abraham and Sarah in Genesis 18. Wondering, waiting, wandering, wishing for a promise that seems to just be dangling right in front of them, but far from the reach. They are disappointed, they are elderly, and they fully understand what it means to live by the phrase, "It is what it is." My mom says that phrase a lot. It is what it is. I hear a lot of people say it, but it seems like my mom says it more than most people do. I really don't like that phrase very much. I don't like it because I think it conveys resignation and it closes the door to imagination in my mind. But for my mom, who is 82 years old, the phrase helps her make peace with the painful realities and limitations in her life. She says it to ward off bouts of disappointment and frustration with my dad, whom she says is having memory lapses, but she forgets that she too is having memory lapses as well. She uses it when she thinks about her creaky knees or her inability to sleep at night or the fact that she never feels rested enough. It is what it is, she says. It's a way of coping for her. It's a way that she is trying to kind of deal with the stagnancy of her life. And in essence, it helps her live. Well, the stagnancy in Sarah's life ends in Genesis 18. When the chaos of the divine comedy begins, we are told that God appears to Abraham as a trio of men. And it's not like Abraham was ready for God's arrival by the oak trees. God just shows up like this unexpected guest who just stops by unannounced. We don't know what made Abraham jump up and run, not walk, but run to the entrance of the tent to meet those guests. We're not sure what it was about them that made Abraham suddenly think, "This is God," or bow awkwardly before them. The text is not clear about what it was that tipped Abraham to God's presence. But I think it's something difficult to describe. That's kind of how it is with our experiences of God. I've heard people try to describe their experiences with God, with God's presence, and they say, "I don't really know how I knew," or "I can't explain the feeling," or "It was something like I had never experienced before." Sometimes finding God is like the songwriter Chris Rice says, is like trying to smell the color 9. The presence of God is like that. It's beyond words. It's beyond description. And we would do well to follow Abraham's example. When he experiences the presence of God, Abraham runs to that presence and he attends to it. Abraham welcomes it. Abraham nurtures that encounter with God. And boy, does Abraham go overboard in his response. Abraham encourages the trio to rest under the oak trees and then refresh themselves. And he says, "I'll give you a little bit of water and a little bit of bread," and that he is going to provide it for them. Now, when I hear a little bit of water and a little bit of bread, I think a spot of tea with some crumpets of some sort, right? Crackers, maybe a pitcher of fresh water, maybe fresh fruit in the heat of the day. That sounds like enough to me. That's not what Abraham did here. Abraham hurries back to the tent to order Sarah to take 3 measures of their best flour to make cakes for their guests. Now, a measure is the equivalent of 2 gallons of flour. And Abraham wanted 3 of them. In other words, he wanted enough bread to make about 50 big cinnabons for his guests. And then he orders a calf to be slaughtered and prepared for them. And like when a much smaller animal would have been fine for 3 people, he uses a calf, which is a sign of royalty, if anything. And then Abraham goes through the painstaking effort. Actually, he orders his servants to do this. He doesn't do this, but he has his servants do this, of providing the rich curds and the milk. And all the while, the guests are just kind of waiting. They're lounging there under the oak trees. They're waiting there, no doubt, all day for this hospitality to come. And meantime, Abraham is sending his whole household into a frenzy of preparation for these 3 men that he claims are God. And when the food finally is made ready and presented to the guests with much fanfare, Abraham waits in their presence. And while Sarah and all the servants collapse, no doubt, in exhaustion in a nearby tent, no doubt muttering nasty things about Abraham, audibly, more no doubt, while they're there doing that, exhausted, panting away, and the three guests are wolfing down on yet another dinner roll, the three ask about Sarah's whereabouts. And one says that the next time that he returns, Sarah will have a son. And Sarah, exhausted, worn out Sarah, who is still sweating from hours of meal prep, whose forearms are still sore from kneading dough and these great masses, these lifting, working around hot stoves and ovens, is still bitter from decades of disappointment and unkept promises, hears what's been said and does what many of us would do if we hear it. She laughs. Not like how her husband laughed in chapter 17. No, it certainly seems as if her laugh is an eruption stemming from doubts and disbelief. In the classic Disney musical, Mary Poppins, there's this whimsical little diversion from the main story in which Mary and the children are called to a house by their good friend Bert to attend to Uncle Albert. Uncle Albert is now floating in the air, right? Because he cannot stop laughing. And the memorable song, which then follows, includes this description of different kinds of laugh. And Mary sings, "Some people laugh through their noses," sounding something like this. Okay, I'll do it. That's what she does. So, and then some people laugh through their teeth, goodness sakes, hissing and fissing like snakes. And then it goes over to Uncle Albert, who's going, tss. And she says, of course, "Not at all attractive in my way of thinking." And then Bert says, "Some people laugh too fast." And then some people only blast, and others twitter like birds. I'm not certain what Sarah sounded like, but based on the history and the timing of such a pronouncement, I would guess that Sarah's laugh was what Bert described as a blast. Pent-up frustration and disappointment, along with exhaustion and resentment, come bursting out in a laugh of bitterness. And I know this translation says that she laughed by herself, suggesting that she was laughing through her teeth, like Uncle Albert hissing like a snake. But the word here used for laugh suggests that it was a laugh that came from her gut. It came potentially from that disappointed womb inside of her. It was a blast of laughter that perhaps was done in private, but no doubt it was heard by many. Heard by many, who, including God, who asked why Sarah had laughed. Sarah tried to deny it, but God wouldn't let her denial go unchecked. "Oh, yes, you did. Oh, yes, you did laugh," he says. And if I were Sarah, I might have said, "Okay, so what if I did? So what if I did laugh?" Sometimes God just seems funny to me. Sometimes God just seems absurd. The miracles, the experiences, the messages, the prophecies, the wonders, the power, the promises, they seem quite frankly unbelievable sometimes. And other times, belief in God just seems really cruel and blind. It seems ungrounded in reality, really darkly comical. I know belief in God and God's promises, belief in Jesus and the tenets that you hear on a Sunday morning like this one, they just don't make sense. And they often just stir up anger and cynicism. Anger and cynicism because I think you hear the burdens of your, or you bear the burdens of your own lives, and you're troubled by the pain of people around you, and you're well aware of the bloody bodies and the weeping children and the shackled immigrants. And all we sing about is hope in our Savior who will make all things right. Ha! Ha! Come on, I can hear Sarah say what many of us are afraid to say out loud. It is what it is. Many of you know that I've worked as a healthcare chaplain for about 5 years. First as a hospital chaplain and for 2 years, and now as a hospice chaplain. And many times, I find that families and patients are so bound up either by pain, by fear, by anger, or flat-out confusion and frustration that they are unaware of their feelings and doubts and how it's affecting them in that particular moment. Like, it's literally keeping them from hearing correctly and listening correctly. Family members are wrestling with either confusing information or devastating news. Patients are struggling with their own pain and discomfort, their own frustration with staff that, despite their best intentions, are unable to completely satisfy the patient or their needs. And I have found that sometimes it's laughter that helps break not only the tension in the room, but also just helps in the mindset. Many times I've walked into a patient's room and I've said, "So how's it going?" And the response has been a bland "great" or "okay." And I will respond with sometimes fire back because I realize what I've just asked. I realize how it's just taken. And I'll say, "I know that's a really crappy question," but sometimes I say it without thinking it. Or I may say, "Well, you're in the ER, so you can't be doing great." And I have found that even that little chuckle, that little small bit of honesty in that moment brings about a small blast of laughter and will cause a crack in the mood, just a crack that's wide enough to make room for a ray of joy, wonder, imagination, hope, and maybe even a little faith to sneak in. It's been said that laughter is the best medicine, and I believe it's true. Back when I was a hospital chaplain on my long ride home, I started listening to stand-up comedians because I just needed to laugh. But then I found out that it was not only important for me to laugh at comedians, but also at the absurdity of what I experienced at the hospital and later with my hospice patients. And let me be honest, the things that I laughed at would probably be considered by many of you to be quite dark and troubling. But somehow, that laughter, that reminiscing about the absurdity of it all, the asymmetry, the chaos, it just brings me laughter. As Richard Pryor would say, if you're not laughing, you're crying. And when I laugh, it's as if a hole has been punched in the clouds, in veil of darkness. It's as if the stagnant water has begun to flow again. Using a medical term, it's as if a stint has been opened up in a vein, has opened up a vein and freed up the blood flow. That's the thing about Sarah here. She's not able to see the wonder of this moment because she's been so disappointed by time, by aging, by an empty cradle. But she laughs. God asks her why, but she can't be honest with herself. She's rigid, she's inflexible. Sarah's laughter serves as this corrective, a realignment so that she can be more empathetic, be more aware of the wonder of God. Henri Bergson wrote about this in his essay about laughter when he pointed out that true life is defined by movement and adaptation and flexibility. Comedy, Bergson wrote, highlights that inflexibility. So, for example, Bergson says that in slapstick comedy, when a person falls awkwardly and suddenly we laugh because all of a sudden a body gives us the impression of something inanimate and rigid that suddenly is susceptible to being controlled by gravity rather than being fluid and self-correcting. Laughter, Bergson writes, corrects our rigidity by interrupting and disrupting our inflexible ways of thinking. And isn't this what we see in the account of Sarah and the promise of God? She laughs and asks God, "Is anything too wonderful for God?" No, God asked that, actually. "Is anything too wonderful for God?" And we learned that no, nothing is too wonderful for God. God, Sarah has a baby despite the odds and the physiological limitations. It happens. And so she appropriately names the boy Yitzhak, Isaac, which means laughter. It's a reminder of the moment when her faith was set free. The wonder of God was made clear. Could it be that the first sign of faith isn't some intellectual understanding coming from our ability to put two and two together, but a corrective blast from the belly, breaking through our rigid thought pattern of bitterness? Could it be that our laughter at the absurdity of God, God's power, God's love, God's amazing grace brings us closer to faith than it pulls us from it? Some time ago, a movie based on the literal reading of the Gospel of Matthew was released, and the actor who portrayed Jesus was quite striking in that he smiled often during the film. Typically, Jesus is portrayed as a somber man of sorrows, but this Jesus radiated throughout the entire film with this broad, gleaming smile throughout every scene. During one particular scene, we find the disciples on the boat in the Sea of Galilee in the middle of a storm, and Jesus comes out to them walking on the turbulent water. And Jesus calls to Peter to come out to him on the water, and Peter does, like the Gospel of Matthew says. And for his few steps, he is stepping on the surface of the sea, we watch, as if he's walking on a waterbed, swaying here and there, bending and bobbling, right? But then Peter begins to sink. And in the gospel account, Peter cries out for help, right? And Jesus pulls him up, which is exactly what takes place in the movie. But the significant change happens next. In the gospel, Jesus says to Peter after he rescues him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Which has always sounded to me like a scolding. But in the movie adaptation, Jesus pulls Peter up and he laughs. He laughs really hard and full from his belly. He laughs, he says, "Oh, you little faith, why did you doubt?" And he embraces Peter, and he laughs, and he laughs, and he laughs. And suddenly, the image of Jesus pulling people out of the water isn't a scolding anymore, but a moment in which a relationship is strengthened and trust is restored. It's like a parent who's teaching their child to ride a bike, holding on to the seat of the bike as the child pedals tentatively, and the parent lets go, and the child keeps riding on without knowing that the parent is no longer holding onto the seat. That is, until the child starts to wonder, looking around, and notices that the parent is no longer holding onto the back of their bike. And what happens? They start to wobble back and forth, and they fall. And you, if you're a parent, you know the mix of feelings that you feel in that moment. But let me tell you something. Mostly, it's not disappointment. It's the joy that they even tried, that they got as far as they did. And so you laugh. That's what a good parent would do. Not with a scolding, but with laughter. "Oh, my child, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Let's do it again." Why did Sarah laugh? Because it was a gift. It was a gift. A gift from God to break her inflexibility and her rigidity and open her to faith. Why did Sarah laugh? Because maybe she heard God laugh too. Laughter, after all, is inherently social, where we as empathetic creatures echo what we hear in others. So maybe Sarah laughed with God at that moment, and she just didn't know it yet. I like that thought. Sarah laughing at life, Sarah unknowingly laughing with God. Me laughing at life, and God laughing with me. May the words of my mouth, the laughter from my gut, and the meditations from my heart be pleasing to you, my Lord, my strength, my holy comedian. Amen.